Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for being here for this lecture. And thank you, Mark Franco. Thank you, Ms. Capioli, for inviting me. And thank you to all your staff for the efforts you have done to organize my coming here and our meeting this evening. As you already know, as it has been said, I am by no means a specialist of dance. And because I am by no means a specialist of dance, your invitation is both an honor and a surprise for me. But I came up with my own explanation about my presence here in this event, and also about the fact that my English being not so good, I am obliged to read. I apologize for that. You have, my explanation is the following. You have called upon me, perhaps because I dance with concepts, with disciplines and genres in my essays and novels. So I thank you then for having invited me to consider that my contributions to contemporary thought with concepts like intertextuality, strangeness, the significance of language, the subject and process, abjection, or the last one, which I call reliance, about the experience of motherhood, to name only a few, that all those concepts can be understood and practiced as dance, which, as I see it, is this nimble movement of incorporated thought. Dance as a nimble movement of incorporated thought. I say nimble movement of incorporated thought, and in risking this definition of dance, I still cannot promise to construct a working theory of your practice. Perhaps this will be possible after having clarified several preliminary ideas for outside of your field. Yet, working in its proximity and attentive to your research, I ask myself, if dance, or rather dances in plural, have always accompanied religious rites and their offshoots, if men and women's dancing is inseparable from the experience of this homo religiosus, which is homo sapiens, how it is possible to dance if God is dead? In saying God is dead, I am referring to an event that happened in Europe and nowhere else, which cut ties with religious tradition. An unprecedented event, the way of which was paved by the Greco-Judeo-Christian tradition. But God is dead also means that some use religion as a political tool, if not a political weapon, as in the case of religious fundamentalism. Hannah Arendt already established that those who use God for political aims are also, if not more, nihilistic than the self-declared nihilists. And what about conflicts between religions? What about the junction and elucidation of the need to believe and the desire to know? Such is the question I investigated in one of my last books. All of them are translated into English by Columbia University Press. But the one in which I try to investigate it, The Need to Believe, is called The Incredible Need to Believe from 2007, and the English tradition is 2009. And it is the question of the 21st century. We cannot respond to it without continuously refounding this other space which detached itself from the religious continent and which is precisely secularism or humanism. It was built in Europe starting in the Renaissance and developed through the 18th century with Erasmus, Diderot, Voltaire, Rousseau, Goethe, and many other rebels, up until Freud and his successors, who have inspired my reflection. I understand humanism in the sense of Nietzsche, who speaks about what he calls transvaluation of values. And he understands this transvaluation of values as, I'm quoting, a big question mark on matters of weighty seriousness. Big question marks on matters of weighty seriousness. Such work is endless, exorbitant, and long time. It is a matter of taking the crisis that is shaking our world seriously. We are undergoing not only an economic, political, and social crisis, but an existential one, in which we are confronted with a major unknown. What is a man? What is a woman? The interminable response to this question associates, I believe, today's crisis with the crisis of Homo sapiens. Concretely speaking, it is a question of human identity in general, and subsequently of the crisis of our multiple identities: sexual identity, ethnical, racial, national, religious, familial. This crisis calls upon the human sciences, which developed following the disintegration of the theological continent 2 centuries ago. But this response depends equally on our possibility or not to create new languages, new literature, new painting, new dance. In the 13th, 14th century, Dante Alighieri, in his Divine Comedy, looked for a language capable of exceeding the human, he says. And he forged a new word to express this need to exceed the human. He called it transhumanar, transhumanar, transhuman, was the term he used, a neologism representative of what is called his new style. Rather than the most exigent theory, I hope it will be dance that speaks one of the new languages of the human comedy. Dance is a radical gesture of this transhumanar, which humanity needs if we refuse to wallow with this economic inevitable crisis that the growth of technology and the virtual finance has imposed on men and women. If, on the contrary, we want to sense the seeds germinating while awaiting the much desired renaissance to come. In this spirit, I must first speak what I mean by humanism. The ambition to define it has often given rise to fabulous claims or even disappointment when its meaning was misconstrued, leading to impasses, impostures, or even crimes. Invited by Pope Benedict XVI to a recent interreligious meeting for peace in Assisi in October 2011, as a humanist at the head of a delegation of not-believers, and this for the first time in the long history of religions, I developed 10 principles of humanism, which I would like to introduce to you. I will then uphold that new political actors are incarnating and realizing this refoundation of humanism, which the globalized world dearly needs. I will take as example 2 of these experiences, which cruelly lack, in my sense, they lack a means of expression in today's codes of humanism. And those 2 actors will be adolescents in want of ideals and maternal passion at the crossroad of biology and meaning. At these crossroads of body and meaning, of biology and sublimation, it is perhaps dance, more than other translinguistic experience, that informs and accompanies the process of transhumanization as it counters the crisis, it exceeds the impending threat of apocalypse. Now, let me say how I present it to the Pope, and then you'll ask me how he reacts to this, but it will be in the discussion. The 10 principles for the humanism in the 21st century. What is humanism? I'll take the Nietzschean definition. A great question, not about humanism, but about thinking. And I put this to humanism. What is humanism? A great question mark on the most serious of issues. This reality is a product, I said it already, but I have to repeat it, it's a product of the European Greco-Judeo-Christian tradition, as already mentioned, and at the same time, it continues to promise to disappoint and to reconstitute itself. Here I stray a bit from dance, of course, but it's with the conviction that the deeper sense of your research converges with the turmoil at the very depth of our civilization. So my first principle is that the humanism of the 21st century is not a theomorphism. Neither value nor ulterior goal, man with a capital M, does not exist. After the Holocaust and the Gulags, humanism has a duty to remind men and women that we are not the only legislators, but it is uniquely through the continuing questioning of our personal, historical, and social situation that we can make decisions for society and history. Today, far from deglobalization, some of us more anarchistically inspired say we have destroyed globalization. I'll say far from deglobalization, it is necessary to invent new international rules to regulate and control finance and the global economy, and finally to create a world authority based on universal ethics and solidarity. So questioning and not absolute men. The second principle, humanism is a process of permanent refoundation that develops through the ruptures that are innovations. Memory does not regard the past. Memory is today. The Bible, the Gospels, the Quran, the Rig Veda, the Tao live in the present. In order that humanism might develop and refound itself, the moment has come to reinterpret the moral codes built throughout history, without weakening them, in order to problematize them, to renew them in the face of new singularities. My third principle is that humanism is a feminism. The liberation of desire could only lead to the emancipation of women. The battle for economic, legal, and political parity necessitates a new reflection also on the choice or not choice and responsibility of motherhood. Secularization is still the only civilization that lacks a discourse on motherhood. This passionate bond between mother and child, throughout which biology becomes meaning, alterity and word, is a reliance, I said it in French, that I come back to this, reliance, a new kind of line, of link, and confidence also. A reliance that, while different from the paternal function, and different from religiosity too, completes the participation in full in the humanistic ethics. The fourth principle, in order that the desire of men and women be rekindled, humanism teaches us to take care of them. The loving care for each other, the care of the earth, the young, the sick, the disabled, the elderly dependent, constitute inner experiences that create new proximities and surprising solidarities. We have no other way to experience the anthropological revolution already announced by the lips of the sciences, from uncontrolled process of technology and funds, and the inability of pyramidal democratic model to properly channel this innovation, no other means than to develop inner experiences in connection with all those that are different until disabled and the end of the life. The second principle, man does not make history, but we are history. For the first time, Homo sapiens is capable of destroying the earth and himself in the name of his beliefs, religions, and ideologies. Similarly, for the first time, men and women are able to reassess in total transparency the constituent religiosity of human being. I say that religious feeling is constituent to the human being. But the hypothesis of destruction is not only possible, the only possible one. No one knows what kind of human being will succeed us. We who are engaged in the unprecedented anthropological and cosmic transvaluation. The refounding of humanism is not a providential dogma, nor an intellectual game. It is a gamble. The age of suspicion between religions and between religions and non-religions is no longer enough. Faced with increasingly grave crises and threats, the time has come to gamble. We must dare to bet on the continuous renewal of the capacity of men and women to listen and to learn together, so that the multiverse, as you know, astrophysicians don't speak anymore about the universe, but about the multiverse because of the differences of cosmic spaces. I think that we have to apply this to the social field, where every one of us is a different universe and the whole system is a multiverse. You have to respect this multiplicity as we respect the belief and the will to not believe or to know what belief is. So, the multiverse, which is surrounded by a void, mankind in it can continue to pursue his creative destiny for a long time to come, only if we can respect this multiverse. In this multiverse, there are two new political actors that speak very particularly, I think, to creators such as yourselves, regarding this language that surpasses the human. This language, which I believe dance to be. And these two actors are, as I already announced, adolescence and maternal passion. Now, let me precise why I consider that adolescence is particularly requiring the attention of every creators of imaginary practices, be it music and literature, and painting, particularly dance, maybe. You remember, maybe, some of you who have some knowledge about Freudian theory, that the adolescent, according to Freud, is opposed to the child. Why? Because the child is a polymorphic pervert, according to Freud. He has all kinds of excitation, all his erotical zones are excited, he plays with them. But he also wants to know, says Freud, where babies come from. And that's why Freud compares the child to a laboratory researcher. Not only the child is a polymorphic pervert, but he is a laboratory researcher, which is very interesting and promising for our children. But opposed to this, what is the adolescent? The adolescent is a believer. The adolescent is not a researcher in a laboratory. He is a believer. We are all adolescents when we are enthralled by the absolute. Freud did not preoccupy himself with adolescence. He wrote a lot about children, but not very much, not even at all, about adolescence. I thought because maybe he was himself a firm non-believer. maybe the most irreligious human that ever exists. Faith implies a passion for what psychoanalysis calls an object relation. Faith is potentially fundamentalist, as is the adolescent. Romeo and Juliet are excellent examples of this. I'll come back to them later. However, because the sadomasochistic nature of our drives, our excitations of the child, our desires, because the sadomasochistic nature of our desires is inevitable, adolescent belief in the ideal object, he believes that the ideal object exists, because of the sadomasochistic basis of his desires, this object and this belief are continually threatened. I will assert then that the adolescent is a believer of the object relation, which means of love, and also of its impossibility. Thus formulated, the question implies a parameter that we have trouble taking seriously. This parameter is ideality. What is this ideality syndrome of the adolescent? The adolescent Oedipus complex is violent because it operates on the carrier wave of idealization. The adolescent whose psyche is rooted in the polymorphous perversity of the young child separates, when he is adolescent, from the parental couple by replacing it with a new model. In doing so, the narcissism of the ego and the narcissism of the child, tied up with the ideals, the adolescent ideals, overflows the object, giving way to an amorous passion specific to the drive ideality intrication. The intensity of this satisfaction is procured thanks to something not sufficiently brought out in Freudian theory, namely the inclusion of the love object in narcissism happens in the guise of belief. The adolescent acquires the certainty that there exists an absolute satisfaction and there exists an absolute object, the love object, that will give him this absolute satisfaction. That he or she can erase the original and tragic Oedipus complex and rush towards a new love that will open the doors of a new paradise. It's not mama, it's not papa, it will be somebody else, and this will give me the absolute satisfaction. Images, ideologies, different forms of knowledge and existential models are all brought into play to shore up an idealized narcissism unfurling over others and which surpasses in strength all former ideals. Ideality dominates the adolescent in conscious. Adolescent drive and pleasure are structured not only as a language. Lacan says that unconscious is structured like language. I say adolescent link to the others is structured as an ideality. He wants, he needs, or she something ideal, something absolute, an absolute satisfaction. Let me sum up as follows. The belief that there exists an ideal object, be it a partner or a profession or a creation or a religious or a revolutionary thematic, this is accompanied by an absolute belief that the parental couple must be surpassed and even abolished, that the law, that the regularity, that what is rigid, what is limited, can be abolished and that an above ideal could be built, so that the adolescent subject can escape into an idealized, paradisical variant of absolute satisfaction. The Judeo-Christian paradise is an adolescent creation. The adolescent takes pleasure in the paradise syndrome, which conversely can also become a source of suffering if absolute ideality turns into cruel persecution, because he believes that the other, surpassing the parental other, not only exists, but that he or she provides him with absolute satisfaction, the adolescent believes that the great other, God, exists and is pleasure itself, an absolute pleasure, a paradise. But the slightest disappointment of this ideality syndrome casts him or her into the ruins of paradise and leads him towards delinquent conducts. We understand that structured by idealization, adolescence is constituted not only through ideality, but through what I call a malady of ideality. Because it is everything, it's infinite, it's absolute, but it is never, never satisfying, so it pushes me to delinquent conducts. Structured so by his propensity for belief, the adolescent is easily carried away by enthusiasm, romanticism, and even fanaticism. The adolescent is a mystic of the object of love. When this fantasy fails to direct him toward a process of sublimation, when he fails in school, profession, or vocation, the failure of the paradise syndrome inevitably leads to depressivity, suicide, melancholia, which takes the form of some boredom. First, if I don't have everything, I get bored, and opens the way to delinquent conduct. But this conduct is merely the flip side of the malady of ideality, since the need for ideality persists beneath the delinquency and supports aggressive behavior. It in no way signals the abolition of the ongoing ongoing destruction of ideality. So even when the adolescent is suicidal or delinquent, he is still an idealist. He is asking for an ideal. And we have to decipher this need for ideality even beneath the delinquent or radical destructive conduct. Another example of this ambivalence and the malady of ideality, too much and nothing is enough, it's the drug addiction. The drug addiction abolishes the conscious, but fulfills the belief of the adolescent in the absolute, of orgasmic regression, orgasmic jouissance, orgasmic pleasure that will be infinite. Within the experience of hallucinatory pleasure. On the other hand, anorectic behavior breaks with the maternal line and reveals the young anorectic woman's battle against femininity. She doesn't have to have this blood, this heavy, this greasy body, etc., that have some mumps, etc. Yet this self-destruction, this death wish, operates to the benefit of an over-investment in the heart-lined body, which echoes back to the fantasy of an absolute spirituality against the flesh, the spirituality. There is this tendency, this pushing towards idealization in the anorectic development. Through this fantasy, the entire body disappears in a beyond charged with paternal connotations. I'll give an example of Romeo and Juliet as an ideal and impossible couple, with another example of this malady of ideality. The perpetuation of the paradise syndrome, notably in the bourgeois couple, has become a pillar of the established, now globalized social order maintained by hackneyed television soap operas and magnified by gossip magazines. This ideal and thus impossible couple is, of course, in the heart of the classic ballet and persists in modern dance. Its prototypes are Adam and Eve, Dante and Beatrice at the firmament of heaven, and Romeo and Juliet. In our culture, Shakespeare's 1564, 1616, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, written in 1591 or 1594, is the paradigm of this fantastical construction. The mutual idealization that two adolescents share is experienced as a rejection of parental authority. Romeo and Juliet's love for one another is all the more fueled by the fact of their ideal couple defy the Montague and Capulet clans who hate one another and engage in a merciless feud. This young couple's ideal is defiant and secret, as all adolescents' acts aspire to be. Moreover, the reciprocal idealization of the two lovers is perceived by all as a fatality. What is fatality? It's very important for a show to demonstrate that there is something fatal. Fatal, this is a fatality in the couple and this ideal love. What is fatality? I would say that fatality is that the absolute belief of his or her pleasure is legitimate and justified, although it is impossible. Here we have this, the fatality is the expression that there is a malady of the ideality. It's absolute and impossible. Several lines of this Shakespearean adolescence resonate with Marlowe's verse that I'll quote. We cannot love or hate of our own free will, for our will is governed by fatality. The fatality of idealized relationships, both indulged and impossible. Nevertheless, as Shakespeare's genius powerfully reveals, the belief that the ideal other inevitably exists is fragile and has difficulty withstanding the assault of the adolescent's latent polymorphous perversity remaining from childhood. Here are two examples which serve to prove this. First, beneath the exalted discourse of the lovers, one perceives sadomasochistic desire. Juliet, for instance, literally cuts up Romeo's body at nightfall. Maybe you haven't noticed it, but I'll quote, come gentle night, come loving black-browed night, give me my Romeo, and when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars. As for Romeo, his jealousy emerges as a fatal pleasure in stabbing his male rivals. Quote, oh, I am fortune's fool, he cries out as he stabs Tybalt and Paris. In the end, this paradisical ideal of the couple turns out to be impossible. Romeo and Juliet die. In 1591 or in 1594, Shakespeare was no longer an adolescent. He had left his wife, Anne Hathaway, and his son Hamlet has just died. Romeo and Juliet, his ninth play in the second cycle of the lyrical masterpieces he wrote along with Midsummer Night's Dream, reads as a farewell to the adolescent belief that the ideal object exists. Let us return to the current state of the affairs and ask ourselves now. How can psychoanalysts, but also the dancer and the spectator, take into account the fact that the unconscious of the adolescent believer is constituted as a high-risk ideality? He needs ideality and finally will be confronted with the non-existence of it, but the crash of the ideality. Civilization, commonly referred to as primitive, have long used initiation rites to assert symbolic authority. When I mean speak about symbolic authority, I mean the divine authority for the invisible world that persists in the initiation rites, but also political authority for the world here. And to justify also in this initiation rites, to justify the acting out of what we could qualify today as perverse attitudes by condoning initiatory sexual practice, where every kind of sexuality will be allowed. In our Western culture, however, notably in medieval Christianity, mortification rituals and excessive fasting channeled the anorectic and sadomasochistic behaviors of adolescents, and in doing so, either downplayed or glorified them. And yet another way, this time secular, what seems to me to be an imaginary elaboration of the adolescent crisis is the birth of the European novel. The European novel, shaped in the Renaissance, was shaped around the adolescent character. The young page serving the lady is a recurrent trope of the country romance in which a complex range of homosexual relations, more or less developed, are played out. Those are some solutions from the past, how they were integrated into the initiation rites or into some genres in the secular culture. Now, those who are some solutions from the past, but today the question for psychoanalysts remains, and for creations of dance too, I suppose, whether we are able to innovate when confronted with adolescence crisis. And if so, how does psychoanalysis avoid the pitfall of stabilizing this crisis of identity into the traditional married couple, the temporary happy end of the bourgeois novel? Even today, popular literature continues to draw from this narrative logic developed during the Renaissance and the 19th century too. Even hardcore sex fails to break out of this logic and is easily assimilated into it. Compared to the diverse ways of dealing with adolescent identity that have preceded us, we might wonder if psychoanalysis is indeed innovative, and if so, how? When we discuss this in psychoanalytic circles, we say that adolescents come to us because they need us to recognize what I called their ideality syndrome, their need for ideal and the impossibility to maintain it into the end. We must so articulate and share our understanding of this necessity to believe that the ideal exists. And then we are to comprehend and accurately interpret the delinquent behavior of the adolescent in the crisis itself as a source of extreme jouissance and search of simile paradise. Only later, when we understand that even into the delinquent conduct they search an ideal object to believe in it, only later should the analyst attempt to point out the negative aspect of this behavior, how false it is, how unacceptable it is, how imaginative it is, how not real it is, etc. And then to conduct this adolescent into a necessary revolt. A revolt is be it of Oedipian or Orestian order. In other words, only the analyst's capacity to recognize and to name the idealizing course of adolescent drives will allow him to provide a credible and effective transference, and thus be capable to metabolize the need to believe, not through nihilist acting out, but through the pleasure that comes with thinking, questioning, and analyzing, and to accompany his rebellious, his doubts, and his malaises in this way, while conserving this universal component, this need to believe, which structures the adolescent. As I tell you about how the analyst is confronted with the adolescent's need to believe, I encourage you to think of how dance can respond on its own particular way to the same needs manifested by adolescent malaise in our civilization. In doing so, we would be better able to interpret the variants of our civilization's new malaise and this new renaissance of the need to believe, which is an unexpected dimension underlying this crisis that I called an existential crisis. A need to believe which everybody shares because we are, all of us, perpetual adolescent. Now, secularization is not only the one that lacks discourse, initiatory procedures and so on about adolescence. Secularization is only the only discourse that lack of discourse on motherhood. We think that we understand what a Jewish mother is or what a Christian mother is for those who believe in these religious fields. But what about a modern mother? What is she in this space between the lover, the woman lover, the working woman, the activist for women liberation and artificial reproduction, or on the contrary, returning to the protective values of traditional family? Every day, the life sciences and obstetrics are gaining growing mastery over the enigma of gestation, which, due to its very status as an enigma, formerly conferred power upon the mother while at the same time anxiously taking it away. And yet feminine fertility and pregnancy not only continue to fascinate our collective imagination, but also serve as a sanctuary for the sacred. The position of modern religiosity would not be to hold the beyond as the place of the sacred, but to try to find out it in the womb, not above our heads, but in the womb. Today, motherhood is imbued with what has survived of religious feeling. Contemporary psychoanalysis offers to shed some light, nevertheless, on maternal passion. And particularly in France, but I know that in England also, and I suppose here equally, the research on early mother-child relations are very important and present a very fertile field of research and innovation in psychology and psychoanalysis. I recently proposed in the symposium we had last year, the French-speaking analysts all over the world, on maternity, I proposed the existence of a maternal eroticism that is not the eroticism of the lover, woman lover. We speak a lot about this in feminism, what is feminine jouissance. We know a little bit about it, although it's always very complicated and difficult to schematize, of course. But I suppose the existence of the other side of the feminine experience, which is not so well investigated by feminism and by psychoanalysis too, which is maternal eroticism. And I called it reliance in this international conference on French-speaking psychoanalysts. This word, reliance, in French carries echoes of the word lien, which is to link or to connect, but also confiance, reliance in English, trust or confidence, as well as, in my mind, it is reliance, religion, as an alternative to religion. Between biology and sense, attachment and expulsion, love and hate, violent influence and generous transmission, maternal reliance is a surprising and necessary version of ethics. We might call it heretics, because in traditional ethics, take this of Spinoza, which is the best described and argumented, it is called that children and women don't belong to ethics. Okay, so we belong to heretics, and reliance is maybe the way to demonstrate how motherly reliance is a part of this universal ethics that we are lacking so much. So maternal passion, understood as reliance, is perhaps the only passion that is not virtual and subjected to spectacular manipulation, and which constitutes the prototype of the love relation. It begins with the pregnant woman's passion for herself, herself reflecting a reinforced and destabilized narcissism. The pregnant woman is losing her identity, for in the wake of the lover father's intervention, she splits in two, harboring an unknown third person, a shapeless pre-object, the future, the embryon, the future baby. In other words, though dominated by narcissism, I am pregnant. Though dominated by narcissism, this initial maternal passion remains triangular, because there is somebody coming and there is the father here. Nevertheless, the absent or inward-looking gaze in the Madonnas with the Child, if you remember the Italian Renaissance painting, they don't look to you, they look somewhere away, such as those of Giovanni Bellini, for instance, openly show that many, what many of us know, that the pregnant woman looks at the father and the world without seeing them. She's elsewhere. So that I call the over-invested and destabilized narcissism. The first stage of this inwardly turned passion is followed by the mother's passion for a new subject, the child, provided that he stops being her double and that she detaches herself from him so that he gains autonomy. This motion of expulsion, of detachment, is essential. This is a way of saying that from the outset, maternal passion is inhabited by negative. It's important to say that there is an ethics which will be reliable, but that it's full of negativity and aggression. You have to recognize and accompany this. Freud was convinced that loving thy neighbor as thyself, as it's said in the Bible and in the Evangelists, was an illusion. He says, loving thy neighbor as thyself is illusion, a pious wish of the Evangelists. Indeed, such love has only been attained by Saint Francis, he says, and other rare mystics like him. I believe, in my own experience, in my practice as a psychoanalyst, I believe that loving one's neighbor as oneself brings us back to this enigma, even more obscure than the mystery of gestation, the enigma that is what Winnicott calls the good enough mother. It is she who allows the infant, if she can love him as herself, it even more than herself, it is this capacity to love the other, this detachment, this negativity from my that detaches me from my narcissism and brings me to the other, that allows the infant to create the transitional space, according to Winnicott, a space which enables the infant to play, to dance, and to think, and to speak, of course. Because it is not easy to love oneself. Generally, it is either impossible or else tragic, although the good enough mother succeeds in loving her child as herself and then as another self. On the cultural level, I've noticed this capacity of maternal reliance to detach from myself, to expose the other, and to consider him as another and to love him as another. I noticed this in the case of what I called in my trilogy a feminine genius, something specific of the feminine attitude towards the world. And feminine genius, which was about three women, we already, Frank Marco noticed it, were destined to the trajectory, biography, and work of Hannah Arendt, Melanie Klein, and Colette. In all these cases, and whatever the attitude towards a real maternity was, some will have children, others not, there is an object relation from the very beginning of the psychic life. This is quite different from Freud's postulation of a narcissism without an object at birth, and also quite different from the masculine genius, philosophers or artists, which is more directed towards solipsistic incantation and the drama of subjectivity per se, and that Hannah Arendt ironized about them. Men's, the melancholic tribe of philosophers that are solipsistic in incantation, in subjectivity per se. So I found this object relationship from the very beginning of the feminine psyche in all those three women as a personal experience and as a project of human relationship in their theoretical works. And yet to maintain that for a woman, and even more so for a mother, there is an other early in the psychic life, when I maintain this, it is not an idyllic position. For this precocious object relation is characterized by instability, an instability likely to turn into manic exaltation or depression or aggression, him or me, projection, identification, and so on. This drama, nevertheless, I'll not get into the conflicts of mother-child relationship, it will be too much psychoanalytic, but what I want to tell about feminine attitude towards the world is that this drama nevertheless has a positive side. Why? Because this passion can allow the mother to create a possible bond with the other, to elaborate the passionate destructiveness underlying all type of relations. And that motherhood, in particular, makes us experience all the more sharply, I love him and I hate him. This is why, with its violent emotions of love and hate, motherhood resembles an analysis of borderline states and perversions. I share the opinions of some authors, psychoanalysts like André Green, for instance, in France, for whom feminine sexuality takes refuge in motherhood to leave out its perversion and its madness, which can also be a way of enabling their working through madness and escaping from madness and be able to live without it. Seduction, fetishization of child's body and its accessories, emotional outbursts, manic states. It isn't rare that the very possibility of thinking is threatened by the mother's passion. It takes on then a more little meaning. However, a certain detachment, depassioning, takes place in most cases. And it's from this that maternal love derives its definitive psychic and vital support. Because most mothers are not in analysis and has no concede that there is something in the very... One has to concede that there is something in the very structure of the mother's experience that encourages this metabolism of passion by depassioning. I suggest considering three factors within paternal passion itself that make that this madness, this borderline experience of aggression in motherhood can be transformed into depassioning. These three factors are the position of the father, the experience of time in motherhood, and the experience of language acquisition. I'll not elaborate of the first two, the father and the time, but I'll say some words about language, because you are elaborating in dance a kind of language. I'll say so a few words only about time, and a little bit time and language in maternal passion. Child language acquisition implies that the mother also relearns language. In the projective identification of the mother and child, I am the child, he is me, I am he or she, etc., the mother inhabits the mouth, lungs, the digestive system of her baby, and by accompanying his echolalia, leads him towards signs, sentences, and stories. Hence, infants become a child, a speaking subject. Each mother accomplishes in her own way the Proustian sense of time past and time regained, à la recherche du temps perdu. As for temporality, referring as it does in Western philosophy to the time of death, as you know, in Plato and until Heidegger, we live and our time goes to death, and we don't have a real experience of time if you don't think about the finitude of our lives. This is this finitude and this death, of course, also haunts the experience of motherhood and the different fears and cares that we are charged with. But in this case, and although this is very present, the mother experience of time is dominated by another caesura, that of beginning. Of course, both parents experience conception and giving birth as initial acts marking a beginning. Yet, the mother feels it most strongly because of the importance of her own body's involvement in the process. For her, this new beginning, that is birth, is not only a conjuration of death. Philosophers have taught us, this is in St. Augustine, but also in Kant, and Heidegger elaborated it, that the logic of freedom does not reside in transgression. We usually think that we are free when we make a transgression, or when we break something that oppresses us. And I want to insist on this because in my experience of liberation in 68 and in different revolutionary movements, we particularly emphasize this notion of freedom as destruction of what is a law, what is a barrier, what is a limit. So this is one notion of freedom as transgression, but the weak side of this, it depends on the limit that we transgress, on the law that you transgress. So Augustine, Nietzsche, Kant, and Heidegger develop something else. They suppose that there is another object, another experience of freedom, which is not a transgression, but the capacity to begin. We'll be free when we will leave this room and take to have a rest, make something new than to hearing in my discourse, for instance. I call this maternal experience of temporality, which is neither the instant nor the retrievable flow of the time, but the repetition of birth, and repetition of birth of children from the second generation when the mother becomes grandmother, etc. I call it duration by means of new beginning. Duration by means of new commencement, new beginning. Being free means having the courage to begin anew. Such is the philosophy of motherhood as a time of new beginning. So what are the excesses which underlie maternal passion? The temporality of maternal passion can be viewed analytically as a kind of detachment, I said passioning and depassioning in the relationship of the soul object, as an invitation of the plurality of beings and relations. The mother has a lot of loves. She loves all her children. And here we see that the notion of absolute is deconstructed. She has different absolutes. She has a multiverse. Maybe she'll prefer one or the other, but essentially her love is to develop in the ideal situation in every child and grandchildren too. It can be seen, this plurality of love, can be seen as the source of depassioning and freedom, which is ultimately freedom from passion. We see that while being the prototype of human passion, maternal passion is also the prototype of the letting go of passion, which allows us to take our distance in relation to what we consider in psychoanalytic experience to be the two tormentors of the human psyche. These two tormentors are the sexual drives, our desires, our energies. See the examples of Strauss-Kahn, for instance. They are the tormentors of our sexual drives that are impossible to dominate. And the other object, the other tormentor, is the object of love. I want to have one object of love, and it's impossible, and it's not good. It's a sin, or it's not allowed to have. And I'm a little bit guilty in our sphere of believing to have several objects of love. So, and that's what happened with this transhumanar, that is maternal passion, which is depassionating too. This brings me to the maternal passion capacity for sublimation. It is because the maternal passion is a continual sublimation that creativity is made possible for the child. And I'll finish with this capacity for the mother to sublimate, and because he has different objects of love, because she's able to depassionate this love, she is able to transmit the capacity to think and to articulate the meaning of the thinking process and to share it through science. Freud had observed what he calls a cycle of sublimation in the emission and reception of jokes. I'll have an example about what is called the sublimation process in the emission and reception of jokes, the witticism. Indeed, the author of the joke neutralizes his affects by communicating only his surface thought. He's neutral. He doesn't enjoy what he says. He doesn't demonstrate any kind of affect or sensation or feeling or whatever. He's just expressing some surface thought. He stands back from his sexual drives and latent thoughts and only invests his listener's attention. How the listener will experience my story. The storyteller's pleasure is doubled then when the listener understands the hidden meaning of the joke, be it a trap. The listener experiences the ambiguous pleasure of understanding that was trapped. This cycle of sublimation is comparable to what happens when mother and child exchange words and thoughts. For this exchange involves the emission of enigmatic words, enigmatic signifiers, preverbal or verbal by the mother, that the child does not understand firstly. Then It understands, the circle understands the withdrawal of the mother's sexual drives. Her attentiveness is only focused on the reaction of her child alone. And the surplus of pleasure is created by the child's response. So the mother does not invest her own message, but only the child's response, from which she procures even greater jouissance, and which in turn she magnifies or encourages. Those who claim that maternal passion lacks humor are mistaken. If mothers can transform their hold on the child into a sublimatory cycle resembling that of the witticism and which promotes the pleasure of thinking, then we can understand what Hegel says when he claims that women are, I'm quoting, the eternal irony of the community. It is something that we couldn't understand in the feminist period in the 80s. I don't know if he was thinking about what I'm saying, but in the need of witticism in the transmission of language, when the mother escapes from her hold on the child, is withdrawn herself, sacrificed in a sense herself, and wants him to go on, be it first a trap, an error, and then he will correct himself and so on. There is something of this kind of irony that mothers are supposed to lack, and that they are invested in the transmission of language itself. To put it differently, by her progressive passioning and or by her aptitude for sublimation, the mother allows her child to represent not the mother, but the mother's absence. I absent myself from the communication. It's up to you to understand or to be trapped. If and only if she leaves the child free to appropriate maternal thought by recreating it in his own way, by thinking and representing. The good enough mother of Winnicott will be she who knows how to leave, to make room for pleasure, for the child and for thought. To leave room, in other words, to disappear. Thus, a kind of symbolic matricide operates through the child's acquisition of language and thought, which diminishes his need to take pleasure from the mother's body. He comes to find pleasure in thinking, first with his mother, as far as the intermittent nature of maternal thought permits, and then alone in his or her stead. So we have seen maternal passion as cleft between the mother's hold over her child, narcissism, identification with him, and sublimation. This division makes the risk of madness ever present, and yet this very risk offers a perpetual chance for culture, because I have to confront this madness and to elaborate it and bypass it. Religious myth, and I will say not only myth, but myths, all religion myths, spun their webs around this divide. In the Bible, the woman is a whole, such is the meaning of the Hebrew word woman, nekeva in Hebrew, which means the whole. But she is a whole, but she is also a queen. So we have this double aspect, this cleavage, she is cleft. The Virgin is a whole in the Christianity because she doesn't exist in the Trinity. We have Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. They turn around a non-visible, non-expressed position where is the Virgin. But she's also a queen of the Church. So we have this power and this non-existence. By these imaginary constructions, religions address the maternal divisions. They recognize it, but they perpetuate it. They found a way of balancing it, but they don't allow women to bypass it. A kind of working through of maternal madness came of this, one which made possible the existence of humanity endowed with a complex psychic functioning, capable of having an inner life and of being creative in the outer world. So religions, in a sense, accompany this cleft psyche, but they maintain it in its stage. So they encourage the perpetuation of the generations and the maintenance of maternity in the house and until the web of the religion. On the contrary, by turning all our attention on the biological and social aspects of motherhood, as well as on sexual freedom and equality, which is something connected with the lover, mother-lover, and not the mother as a mother. By all this, we, secularization, we have become the first civilization which lacks a discourse on the complexity of motherhood. My dream is that the arguments I'm trying to develop here will help to remedy this lack, that they will stimulate mothers and those who accompany them to sharpen our understanding of this passion, pregnant with madness, but also with sublimity, and to put this knowledge into our philosophy, our political life, but also in the languages of imagination that accompany mother's experience when we go to the cinema or to the dance representation. This is what motherhood lacks today. Now, let me conclude. The adolescent and the mother are, of course, two eternal actors in human existence that reveal themselves to be, particularly now, because they are more free than in the past to reveal their complexity, they reveal themselves now to be decisive actors in this transhuman hour, in this surpassing of the human that concerns us at the beginning of the third millennium. By incarnating their dramatic experiences, dance could perhaps accompany them with the necessary delicacy that you have in your language with dance, that necessitates also the renewal of your art through the gravity of its buoyancy. Thank you for having given me the occasion to remind you of this.